Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 267, Betrayal at the End. Mnyamana, Cetshwayo's Dutchman, and the Crushing of the Zulu Kingdom. Cornelius Vaen had made a few bad decisions in his life, as we all do at some point. Born in Holland in 1856, he made his way to Natal in 1874, where he rapidly learnt both English and isiZulu. It wasn't necessarily a bad decision. During his childhood, however, he had suffered an accident. He was run over by a wagon. The wheel shattered his leg. It healed badly, and from then on, he walked with a limp. He had lived in Natal for over 4 years before setting out from New Gelderland with 6 Zulu drivers and assistants, 16 oxen, and a wagon loaded with woolen baize and cotton blankets, picks and knives and saddles, bridles and beads. Just to put his location into perspective, New Gelderland is a few kilometers north of KwaDukuza, a.k.a. Stanger. Cornelius Vaen's destination, Zululand. This was a miscalculation, because his journey began October 1879 on the eve of the Anglo-Zulu War. Tension had been rising for months, and most whites had fled the territory. Vaen was determined to go the other way. He sensed he could make some extra money without any competition from the other Natal traders. Vaen was 23 years and 6 months old. After being held up by rainy weather and a border check to make sure he wasn't carrying guns, he crossed to Tugela on November 1st. We know all of this because Cornelius's journal was published by Bishop Colenso in 1880, and you can find a copy online at the University of Cape Town Archives. It's called Cetshwayo's Dutchman, and what a fascinating read it is. His plan was to travel to meet King Cetshwayo Kampande and sell him all the goods in the wagon in exchange for cattle. Soon after crossing the Tugela, Cetshwayo sent for him, not before local men approached and asked suspiciously what he was up to. War was imminent. What was he doing there? His lunch, by the way, on that day, was rice and milk with a piece of dry bread and a cup of coffee with sugar. He then had a run-in with Dubulumanzi, Cetshwayo's son, who lived at Izulweni Imuzi near Ishowe, who'd arrived where Cornelius had outspanned, demanding a shot of spirits. He was handed a mug of rum. After a few days, Vaen set off towards Matlabatini, where he arrived on December 22nd. Before the war, everyone was jittery. There was constant talk of war. One day, trader James Rourke visited, and they discussed matters and agreed that, "Certainly our position is anything but pleasant. If war began between the Zulus and the whites, very probably we should also be made shorter by a head." On the 11th of January, as Chelmsford's columns crossed into Zululand in the northwest, 7 Zulu messengers arrived and said King Cetshwayo demanded to see Cornelius Vaen immediately. He duly set off, but on the way Zibebu's impi intercepted him and seized his wagon and all his cattle. Cetshwayo heard of this, and despite there now being a state of war between the English, meaning Natal, and Zululand, the king ordered that Cornelius's goods be returned to him and that he be sent under protection to his Mbelebele homestead to recover. Such was the king's power in the north. Cornelius Vaen's wagon, all his goods and his cattle arrived there 2 days later. As you're going to hear in a moment, in the south on the coast all was not well for King Cetshwayo. The king had good reason to treat Vaen well. He needed someone who could function as a translator and letter writer, because Cetshwayo would spend most of the coming weeks repeatedly sending emissaries to Lord Chelmsford asking for negotiations. In May, word arrived that the Boers were at Cetshwayo's home. They were working together to defeat the British. Later on, Cetshwayo was to tell Cornelius that, "No doubt the Boers are better than the English. Bumpande was set up as king by the Boers and died as king, whereas I, Cetshwayo, was crowned by the English, and now my country is to be taken from me." By June, the war had progressed beyond the possibility of negotiating. Many battles had been fought: Isandlwana, Rorke's Drift, Hlobane, Kambula, Gingilovu, and only recently, Prince Louis Bonaparte had died, shocking the English public. On June the 4th, the Dutchman was summoned to appear before Cetshwayo. It was a 2-day ride to Kwambunambi, at times hair-raising as warriors mock-attacked and others shouted insults. Eventually, he arrived at Kwambunambi Kraal. Imnyamahana told Cornelius that Cetshwayo wanted to show the authorities in Natal that he would not summarily kill all white men with good intentions, only those who invaded, like the British Army. Whites and blacks could be friends, he was differentiating. It was Mnyamana who handed a letter to Vane, dated June 4, 1879, written by Lord Chelmsford, which Vane translated. The demands included that Cetshwayo hand back all the cattle seized over the course of the war, all the rifles looted from dead English be returned, and that the king should surrender himself to face English justice. Vane then proceeded to write a number of letters on Cetshwayo's behalf, pleading for negotiations, none of which were taken seriously, because Chelmsford was on a mission to destroy the kingdom. Following the British disaster to St. Luan and the agonizingly slow progress of the second invasion of Zululand, the British government lost confidence in Lord Chelmsford's strategic capabilities. In May 1879, Sir Garnet Wolseley was appointed as Supreme Commander in South Africa, effectively superseding Chelmsford. The Disraeli government sent Wolseley with a clear mandate: end the war quickly and cheaply. Wolseley was given civil and military authority over Natal, the Transvaal, and Zululand. This move was a public humiliation for Chelmsford, signalling that a group of favoured, efficient officers were taking over from the established military elite. When word reached him deep in Zululand, his reaction was one of desperate urgency rather than resignation. Knowing his reputation was on the line, Chelmsford took several decisive actions, including what you may call a race for Undini. Chelmsford was ordered by Her Majesty's government to submit and subordinate your plans to his control. Chelmsford ignored this and various peace offers from Cetshwayo to strike while the Zulu were recovering from their defeats, and to attempt to regain his reputation before Wolseley could remove him from command of his army. He realized that if he could capture the Zulu capital, Undini, and defeat King Cetshwayo before Wolseley reached the front, he could claim the victory for himself. For once, the plodding, entitled commander of the old school managed to move quickly, purposefully moving his headquarters rapidly, making it difficult for Wolseley's couriers to reach him with orders that might have restricted his command or forced a negotiated peace. Meanwhile, John Dunn had been negotiating furiously with the chiefs of the south on the coast, including Chief Ndwandwe, who switched sides to support the English, and it was apparent war weariness was spreading. Muhena of the Mbudu Tsonga people near Lake St. Lucia was contacted by the British consul in Zanzibar, who persuaded him not to join a new army Cetshwayo was trying to form. In early June, Tabula Manzi began to treat with the British, a huge blow for Cetshwayo. Mavume Ngwana too. Then Palani, one of the commanders at the Battle of Gingundlovu, and the towering Samopo, a senior Nduna at the same battle, all admitted they were beaten and asked for terms. Colonel Krellick was leading the 1st Division as it wrecked areas of the Zululand north coast for places their ships could land provisions, and then selected Port Durnford. Starting in early July, British ships began supplying the Empire's soldiers in Zululand from there. These days, it's a sleepy little inlet. Further north, in Richards Bay, a deep water port was built in the 1970s, preferred to the original landing area because it has a large natural lagoon. The chiefs around this area had already felt somewhat exposed, with Cetshwayo calling his Amabuto back to Undini, and Krellick now offered reasonable terms instead of the usual scorched earth method. He offered peace in exchange for royal cattle and their weapons, which meant the Zulu there weren't sacrificing their own herds. Much of the coastal plain abandoned the royal cause long before the Zulu army was defeated. But there Amabuto were already over the mountains at Cetshwayo's great place, and by the third week of June 1879 the Zulu army had assembled once more. Cetshwayo had nowhere to go, unlike Mzilikazi or Dingana, who had fled towards the Tsonga and the Tswazi. Back at Undini, Cornelius Vane had been summoned once more to compose another letter from Cetshwayo, who spoke of peace. In this missive, Vane's role shifted from protected writer of letters to agent and spy. At the end of that note, he scribbled that Cetshwayo's army was nearby and ready for battle. The king had no idea that the man he'd kept safe throughout this campaign had committed this act of treachery. On the 26th of June, Chelmsford's joint force approached Mtunjaneni from Babanango and from the heights they came in sight of the Amakanda in the Amakosini Valley. Unlike Krellick, Chelmsford was destroying all homesteads he came across, and Lieutenant Colonel Wood's mounted contingent and the Natal native contingent, supported by artillery, moved down the valley. A Zulu force of 600 men from the Onukenke and Mxapo were waiting, but when the 9-pounder guns opened up, they hastily withdrew. Before doing so, they set three of the homesteads alight themselves, and the British burned down all six, including a huge quantity of stored mealies. What the Zulu MP hoped was that the British would hurry past the undamaged kraals, because inside one, Isiklebeni, was the most important object in the Zulu Empire, the Inkatha Yezwe Yakwazulu. It was the most sacred symbolic object of the Zulu nation, representing its spiritual and political unity, and made from a core of specially woven grass encased in the skin of a python, an animal associated with royalty and immortality. To imbue it with the essence of the nation, it was smeared with insila, or body scrapings and sweat and dirt, which had been collected from the king and his ancestors, as well as biological matter from conquered enemies, and straw from the doorways of various localized clans. By incorporating these elements, the Inkatha literally coiled the diverse identities and strengths of the Zulu people into a single unbreakable entity, ensuring that the strength of the many was concentrated in the person of the monarch. It served as a mystical coil, binding the people to the king, an umbilical coil. Oral tradition held that King Shaka formalized its importance, although the tradition predated him. It was more than a physical artifact. It was the soul of the nation, and its loss or destruction was believed to signal the collapse of the kingdom itself. Historians and political analysts point to this as one of the British military's greatest strategic oversights, an act of symbolic decapitation that made the subsequent settlement of Zululand almost impossible to manage. Colonel Redvers Buller led a cavalry force across the river to reconnoitre the ground beyond. A party of Zulus were seen herding goats near the Imbalani stream, and troopers moved to round them up. Buller suddenly realized it was a trap. The law of the land meant warriors could exploit the nearby high ground and the grass. Buller bellowed an order for them to stop and prepare to fire from the saddle, and at that moment 3,000 warriors rose from the long grass and fired a fusillade before charging. Three troopers were shot dead. Buller ordered his men to retire. As they dashed back to the river, Baker's horse, who had been scouting further across, took up position and gave covering fire for the crossing. Their crossing, in turn, was covered by the Transvaal Rangers on the opposite bank, and the entire reconnaissance unit had been in grave danger, but survived. Buller's alertness and leadership saved them from certain annihilation. Eventually, Wolseley's messengers caught up with Chelmsford, gave him a direct order. "You are not to undertake any further offensive operations until my arrival," said Wolseley. Chelmsford was not to be stopped. "I shall be prepared to hand over command to you on your arrival, but operations already in progress must be continued." On the evening of the 3rd of July, Chelmsford issued his orders. The British had learned a bitter lesson at San Luana. This time they would take no chances meeting the Zulu army in the open with their normal line of battle. Their advance would begin at first light, prior to forming his 5,500 strong infantry into a large hollow square, with mounted troops covering the sides and the rear. Neither wagon loggers nor trenches would be used this time to convince both the Zulus and critics that a British square could beat the Zulu fairly in the open. At 6 in the morning of the 4th of July, Buller led out an advance guard of mounted troops and irregulars and secured the upper drift of the White Mfolozi. The flying column battalions, as they were being called, followed. By 7:30 in the morning, the column had managed to clear the rough ground across the Mfolozi, although it had been quite a struggle, and then formed up the square, which was actually more of a rectangle. At 8:45, the Zulu engaged the cavalry on the right and left, which slowly retired and passed into the square. The leading face was made up of five companies of the 80th Regiment in four ranks, with two Gatling guns in the centre, and 2 9-pounders on the left flank, 2 7-pounders on the right. The 90th Light Infantry, with four companies of the 94th Regiment, made up the left face with 2 more 7-pounders. On the right, there were the 1st Battalion of the 13th Light Infantry, four companies of the 58th, 2 7-pounders and 2 9-pounders. The rear face was composed of two companies of the 94th and 2 of the 2nd Battalion. In the middle, the headquarters staff, along with No. 5 Company of the Royal Engineers, led by Lieutenant Chard, who'd survived Rorke's Drift, as well as the 2nd Natal Native Contingent. 50 wagons and carts with reserve ammunition, water and hospital wagons made up the rest. Bulu's horsemen protected the front and both flanks of the square, while the rear was protected by 2 squadrons of the 17th Lancers and a troop of the Natal Native Horse. In an incongruous moment there on the Zululand veldt, the band of the 13th Light Infantry struck up, and the 5,500-man-strong living lager began its measured advance across the plain. Chelmsford was actually drilling the troops, warming them up. While they were no longer protected by wagons, there was a tactical advantage to this tight formation. Once the enemy's attack had been broken, the speed at which the cavalry could set off would shatter their will. At least that was the idea. The British were also banking on poor Zulu marksmanship and their preference for fighting with the beloved Ikwa spear. No Zulus in any numbers had been sighted by 8, so the frontier light horse were sent forth to provoke the warriors. As they rode once more across the Mbalani stream, the Zulu Ngombamakosi regiment rose out of the grass in front of them, followed by regiment after regiment. Umtwana Zewedu Kampande led 15,000 men, with a further 8,000 in reserve. Joining him were Sihayo and his son Metloka Zulu. Kechwayo had already left Undini on the evening of the 3rd, travelling east with his Izigodlo of women to the Mlambongwenya Inkanda of his father Mpande. On the broken plain back at Undini, the main horns and chest formation manoeuvred into half-open order, encircling the northeast and southern sides of the square. The Idloko Ubuto were in the chest, aiming straight at the British. The encircling left horn comprised the Utulwana, Indluyengwe, Isatko, Mbube, and Mbunambi. The right saw the Kapo, Insunkangeni, the Ududuru, Ikwa, Nukenke, and Ilondlo. The Ngobamakose and Uve attacked the right rear of the square, then Kriyu, the left. Some Tsonga were also part of this force. A Zulu reserve force of around 5,000 was poised on the west, which appeared to be aiming at Chelmsford's entrenched camp back across the White Mfolozi. At 8:10, the garrison there went on alert. Some of the Zulu began crossing the river, but then events overtook them. The huge Zulu army faced Chelmsford Square, stamping the ground with their feet and drumming their shields with their assegais. The mounted troops by the stream opened fire from the saddle to trigger a premature charge before wheeling back to gallop through the gaps made in the infantry lines for them. At 9 a.m, the 4 ranks of the infantry, with the front 2 kneeling, opened fire at 600 meters into the advancing Zulu ranks. The warriors' pace quickened, the range closing rapidly between the two armies. Zulu regiments had to charge forward directly into massed rifle fire, non-stop fire from the Gatling guns and the artillery, which fired canister shot at point-blank range. Despite the charges made by the Zulus, they could not get close. There were a number of casualties within the square to Zulu marksmen, but the British firing did not waver, and no warrior was able to get within 30 meters of the ranks. The smoke covered the battlefield. Later, it became clear that some of the men inside the square had been firing too high, or the terrible casualties the Amabuto suffered would have been even worse. The Zulu reserve force now rose and charged against the southwest corner of the square. The 9-pounders killed many members of this force, and the infantry opened fire. The speed of the charge made it seem as if the Zulu reserves would get close enough to engage in hand-to-hand combat, but not one warrior reached the British ranks. Then Chelmsford ordered the cavalry to mount, and the 17th Lancers, 1st King's Dragoon Guards, Colonial Cavalry, the Native Horse, and 2nd Natal Native Contingent charged the now fleeing Zulu. The warriors broke and ran towards the high ground, with cavalry at their heels and shells falling ahead of them. The lancers were checked at the Mbalani stream by the fire of a concealed party of Zulu, causing several casualties before they overcame the resistance. The pursuit then continued until the cavalry had cleared Matlabatini Plain, with the members of the Natal Native Horse, Native Contingent, and Woods Irregulars killing all the Zulu wounded, in revenge for similar Zulu actions at Isandlwana and other battles. 3 officers and 10 men died. 69 were wounded. The Zulus suffered 1,500 dead, an unknown number were wounded. The surviving warriors speedily dispersed all over the country. The bush around Undini clogged, with some of the wounded who'd survived the cavalry, as well as old men, women, children, cattle, all fleeing from the Mahlabatini plain. Cetshwayo was one of these, moving northwards from Kwambunambi, crossing the neck of the Ntabankulu range into the thick bush beyond. Mnyamana joined him there. Cetshwayo hardly said a word. What was there to say? He sent his 11-year-old heir, Dinuzulu, to his half-brother Zibebu's home. He was chief of the Mantlakazi, who lived in the northeastern reaches of Zululand. This was going to cause friction. Zibebu naturally presumed he would be called on to lead the Zulu nation after the king's capture. But Cetshwayo's full brother Ndabuko insisted it was proper that he assume the custody of Dinuzulu and Cetshwayo's woman. Cetshwayo's capture was only a matter of time. As the British parleyed with the senior chiefs, it was Mnyamana who shopped the king. During one interview, he let slip, saying, "I have come to tell you that the wind blows from the Ngome forest." A final treachery, and on the 28th of August, Major R.C. Marta and his patrol rode up to a remote Kwa Dwasa homestead of Umkusana Kasamkana, who was an adherent of Mnyamana. Taken by surprise, and at the end of his tether, Cetshwayo surrendered with some considerable dignity, reported Major Marta. Cornelius Vane made it back to Natal alive. Next episode, we'll hear about the divvying up of Zululand, the destruction of an empire, and the growling sound of Boers straining against British rule. It's going to get very busy in the Transvaal. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, Salagatli.